Thank you, Chris, Diane. Only Chris and Diane performed that beautifully, but he wrote that some years back, and we are grateful for you guys filling in and being our guests today. Thank you. Well, happy Thanksgiving to both you and to my friends joining us at Cross Church this morning. Today is going to be a little different in that we're looking at a two-week series entitled Creation and Conception, Obstacles to Faith. When you hear the title of today and the title of next Sunday, I think you're going to have an idea for today. We're looking at, did God create life? Did God create life? We're looking at the specific teaching in present day, cosmology, biology, physics, what have you. We're looking at evolution. Next Sunday, I want to invite you to join me as we conclude the series, just looking at a couple of objections. Why are Christians so pro-life? And we'll be not only answering the question why evangelical Christians and often Catholic Christians are so pro-life, we'll be looking at this question in perspective of science. Does science lead us to a pro-life position? My hope is to provide a lot more light and a lot less heat. I know it's an emotional issue, and be aware that we'll handle it with sensitivity, verbal modesty, as hopefully you would expect from your pastor and your church. Today, did God create life? Did God create life? The Bible begins simply and artistically with these words: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. God's creation of heaven and earth is central to Christianity. In fact, the ancient Apostles' Creed that perhaps dates back to the second century, almost, 1900 years, begins with these words: I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. The tenet that God created everything is, again, in the middle of Christian's teaching. In fact, not only did God create all things, the Bible teaches us, but the Bible goes beyond that. It says he continually cares for his creation. It wasn't a one-time act that he walked away from. In fact, he returns back to it continually. We see in the book of Matthew, the words of Jesus. He says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? God cares for sparrows. And it's an argument from the lesser to the greater. If he cares for sparrows, how much more would he care for you, you who are made in his image? So Christianity, at its central part of its teaching, is that God created all things. And yet, we have a worldview in front of us in modern America that teaches something very different. In fact, all worldviews, the ways in which you see the world, will have a beginning story. No matter where you might come from, if you're a skeptic, if you're a Christian, you're going to have a story of how things came together, how things will one day end. And today we're comparing and contrasting two very different worldviews and the origins of life story. We're comparing naturalistic evolution against Christianity. We're comparing the stories of how naturalistic evolution says we came together and how Christianity has. And since around 1859, this has been a present and pressing debate. It's been a debate since that time because some of you know your history well. You know that Darwin wrote his Origin of Species around that time. About the time we were heading into our Civil War was the time when this was published. In fact, Darwin was not the first Darwinist. His grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, was a famous evolutionist in Great Britain. But Darwinian thought, that is, the idea that we evolved, dates back all the way to ancient Greek thought. But since the mid-1800s, it's been a pressing debate. Perhaps you've seen it spill over in the choice of textbooks at a local school district, or perhaps you were challenged with one form of this teaching or another, even in your school days. So today, our question becomes, can naturalistic evolutionary thought be consistent or reconciled with the Christian faith? Now, throughout this, and perhaps you've encountered these, is what they're calling popularly deconversion stories. In fact, deconversion was a word that my Microsoft word processor didn't even know. I had to teach it. Right-click, learn the spelling of this. Deconversion. What does that mean? Well, in popular lingo, someone has grown up in the faith and they've moved away from the faith, and specifically one of the things is evolutionary thought. In fact, today I've been told there are people who've come, whose loved ones asked them to come because they were at one time faithfully attending church, but they quit attending due to the scientific theories of evolution. Well, one deconversion story is S.A. Joyce. He writes his story, and I quote at length, "In the years after leaving the military, I went back to college, not a serious attempt to earn a degree, but just to improve myself. I came across and pieced together, bit by bit, a humanistic set of values which turned out to be far more self-consistent and pertinent to the modern world than a petrified decalogue of biblical taboo. It was becoming clear to me that the universe behaved pretty much as if you might expect if God didn't exist, or at least he didn't care. It gradually dawned on me that the grand scheme of things was in fact no grand scheme. God performed," he continues, "no observable function. He had no valid purpose. The question entered my mind, what is God without a purpose and for which there is no evidence? And he answers it, non-existent. Non-existent came the obvious answer." He continues, Joyce does, "The blinders of dogma and the yoke of dread were finally off. For me, the universe now shone in wholesome new light, the comforting glow of reality no longer distorted, either by the cartoonish artificial glory of myth and miracle or the dreadful glare of hellfire. I was free." In fact, it's telling to know the title to this deconversion story. Joyce titles it, "One Night I Prayed to Know the Truth, and the Next Morning I Discovered I Was an Atheist." Now today, I want to look at some of the obstacles to evolutionary, naturalistic evolutionary, and the heart of some people's objections to Christianity is the teaching of evolution. In fact, let me give you my purpose. My purpose today is, unlike most sermons, more of a presentation. I want to offer a reconsider for some of you who've been rejecting Christianity due to evolutionary teaching. I want to offer you a moment of pause to circle the wagons, if you will. Do I think I can convert you to my form of thinking within about 30-40 minutes? Not likely. But I do want to give you potentially some pause. Secondly, I want to come alongside Bible-believing Christians and help equip you and letting you know that the story, the Bible story, the origin of the universe has more credibility and evidence than perhaps you thought ahead of time. But I do, if you're a skeptic here today, I've worked diligently not to build straw men, build just feeble, throwaway type of arguments for your view. In fact, I've tried to go and read your textbooks diligently. Now, I'm not a scientist, and the transcripts from my college bear witness to my lack of science. But I am a thinking person, and this morning, if you think I'm biased, and I am biased, I have an opinion concerning this, I invite you to do your own research. In fact, if you would like to use the notes I'm looking at, you can find them at scottmaze.com. Everything I have in front of me is right there right now. In fact, you can look right with me and find out when we're going to go eat lunch. Just know when I'm nearing the end. You can even grade me as far as what I miss and what I hit. But you can look. There's two pages of footnotes in my notes today. You can go and begin looking and doing some of the research and seeing if I crossed my T's and dotted my I's. You see, I believe that we ought to be led by the facts. The facts should lead us. And I think what's happening today is a two-story reaction to this type of origin of life. Let me share with you. The reaction, I've shared with you my purpose. Let me share what the reaction of some might be to laugh me off the platform or the building. In fact, if I were to do what I'm doing here presently, many locations within North Texas, there would be people who'd laugh me out of the building. In fact, some of you know the name Richard Dawkins in his book, The Greatest Show on Earth. He goes so far as to suggest that people who question or deny evolutionary theory are like those who deny the Holocaust. In fact, I want to continue. Dawkins asserts that people who deny evolutionary theory have no intelligence whatsoever. Well, you're about to hear a non-intelligent person move in this direction. You may laugh me out of the building. You may have enthusiastic agreement with me. You may enthusiastically say, I'm so glad that he went in that direction, and I'm so glad that my pastor spoke that. But today, no matter what your reaction might be, I want to ask you to give me a respectful, even if it's an uncommitted hearing, that you would pause enough to potentially hear a credible presentation on this. Our country is divided on this issue greatly. Recent poll, I'll refer to two polls today, one in 2014, one in 2016. A 2014 poll shows the following, that 31% of people believe that humans evolved with God guiding it. This might be referred to as theistic evolution. Second layer that you see there, 42% believe that humans evolved and felt that God created humans just as they are. Still yet, 19% of the people polled believe that God had no responsibility, had no part in the process at all. You can see that almost half of the population believe in some form of evolution of one another. I found it interesting that a USA Today poll said that even Democrats and Republicans are divided on this. Did you know that Democrats and Republicans are divided? Were you aware of that before coming in here today? Well, your reaction may be one of the following. You may laugh me on the platform, you may enthusiastically agree, but let me just share with you this topic is really boiled down to one alternative. Either you and I believe that we're here by chance or by choice. Fundamentally, there's an alternative. We're either here by chance or by choice. We either were created by an intelligent being that I refer to as God, or we were self-created. It's fundamentally can be boiled down to that simple. You may do the research over years, you may attend the lectures, but fundamentally there's one alternative. Either we're here by chance or by choice. All would pretty much agree with that. And a moment ago I referred to this, there's a dichotomy that I would refer to as a two-story home. And it works like this. Science belongs to the first floor, while people of religion and morals, subjectivity, should resolve and live on the second floor. So here's how it looks. If I write a scientific textbook and then I, inside the scientific textbook, talk about naturalism, talk about which functions of atheism, that belongs in the first floor. But if someone like myself were to get up and say, I don't think so, I think there's good evidence for theism. No, you go to the second floor or the back of the bus. You see, I want you to understand something today. Both positions are by faith. You need to understand that. And if there's anything that potentially I would leave you as the one point where you walk away is that both naturalistic evolution and those of us who believe in a creator have both arrived there by faith. Both of us have. You say, not so. Well, no one was there that I know of. I've known some old people, but no one was old enough to be there. No one was present to witness the origins of the universe. No human expert actually knows what happened when he or she might just share with you what they believe. The origins of the universe, in fact, are not a biological question, though it can teach us. It's fundamentally a historical question. And all of our thoughts are but faith explanations. If you're a naturalistic evolutionist, you believe that by faith, and if you're a creationist such as I am, or one who believes intelligent design somewhere in the middle, you believe that by faith. And again today, my hope is that you may just pause long enough to reconsider. Here's where I want us to go today. I want to look at, first, evolution, a closed box. Secondly, the fine-tuning of the universe. And then lastly, I want to talk about creation, open truth. Let me first share with you evolution, a closed box. I've chosen that metaphor because the metaphor of evolution as a closed box is a telling one. Evolution teaches that the universe is a closed box where everything can be explained in purely natural processes and principles. The moment anyone may find evidence for an intelligent being to have kick-started or created things or in any way put a monkey wrench in the process of what we see, well, then that is no longer viable. In fact, evolution is a closed box where no intelligent living being can intervene. In other words, scientific thought, naturalistic evolutionary scientific thought, rules out the possibility at the beginning of any outside intellect or force that may interfere with the universe. When you say, what is evolution, then you need to understand that evolution by itself is a tricky word. If by evolution you mean change over time, then very few of us would disagree with this definition, change over time. I would readily admit that antibiotics evolve. When bacteria or cells evolve to antibiotics, meaning that when you interject a certain antibiotic, it may no longer have the power or the way to solve the bacteria or the cell's disease. It builds up antibodies. And so sometimes we have to change. I would readily give that definition of evolution to you. But when you mean evolution is that all living things evolve by a gradual natural process from non-living matter to simple microorganisms leading eventually to humans, that's where I would object. In fact, within evolution, if you're taking notes with me, under point one, the closed box, I want to give you three components to modern evolutionary teaching that I find objectionable, and I think many other Christians do as well. First, life evolves from common ancestors. Life evolves from common ancestors. What do I mean by that? Well, there are some 300,000 different species of, or different beetles alone, I shouldn't say species, but 300 different beetles alone, 17,000 butterflies. There are thousands of mammals, fish, birds, all astonishingly different. And how did these species come to being? Well, according to the National Association of Biology Teachers website, the board of directors use this to define evolution. You'll see on the screens. The principle of biological evolution states that all living things have arisen from common ancestors. Now, what this means is that all present life emerging gradually over time from one or very few common ancestors. Now, maybe you're as confused about the monkey that came out of the library. I don't know if you've heard about this monkey. He came out of the library with a Bible under one arm and Darwin's Origin of the Species under the other arm. And somebody asked the monkey, "What is it you're doing?" "So I'm trying to find out if I'm my brother's keeper or my keeper's brother." When we look at evolution, we're looking at the teaching that we come from common ancestors. One more. Again, the National Association of Biology Teachers and their website. You'll see this again. Even as biologists continue to study and consider evolution, they agree that all living things share common ancestors and that by the process of evolutionary change through time is driven by natural mechanisms. So let me see if I understand this correctly. From what I understand, this form of naturalistic evolution functioning as atheism wants to teach me that somehow an initial cell evolved into a fish, and this fish evolved into an amphibian. That amphibian evolved into a reptile. The reptile then evolved into a mammal. The mammal would then evolve into a bird. The bird would then evolve into an ape, and the ape evolved eventually into a human. This is what this form of evolutionary teaching would have us to believe. The evolutionist wants us to believe that nothing times nobody equals everything. Fundamentally, there's one alternative. We either came together by chance or by choice. Perhaps the best way to summarize this first aspect of the common ancestor is in a little poem. Perhaps you'll want to remember this. "Once I was a tadpole beginning to begin, and then I was a frog with my tail tucked in. Then I was a monkey hanging from a tree, and now I'm a professor with a PhD." The first aspect, that's okay to laugh, it's all right. Even to disagree with me, that's a funny thing to say. The first aspect of a closed box of evolution is that we come from common ancestors. Secondly, the second component to evolutionary teaching is that life comes from non-life. That life originates or arises from non-life. Evolution believes that life itself emerges from non-living matter. Now, the theories, from what I can tell, change depending on when you read it. Meaning, if I read this 100 years ago, the theory changes, or if I read this off of a textbook or a website within the last few weeks, it depends just who you're reading and how the theory goes. But particularly insightful is a 1976 debate that happened right in our backyard in Denton at the University of North Texas. In 1976, two individuals, creationist and philosopher Thomas Warren, asked renowned then atheistic and evolutionary philosopher Anthony Flew. Flew is now deceased, and he famously deconverted from atheism, and he converted to theism, which is not the same thing as a Christian. But you need to know at this time that Flew is an evolutionary and an atheist. When the two debated on the campus of the University of North Texas in 1976, Warren asked Anthony Flew a simple question: have you ever seen or witnessed or know any knowledge of a non-human being ever transforming into or giving birth to a living being, human being? Have you seen a non-human being transform or give birth to a human being? That's fundamental to the aspect of naturalistic evolutionary teaching. Flew said, no, I have not. I have no knowledge of this. But then Flew toward several days in the debate, and you can find the whole debate on YouTube, 7 hours in length, intriguing. Flew said this later on, I quote, about whether I've met anyone who was not unequivocally either human or non-human, yes, yes. Pay attention. Yes, I'm afraid I have. I have met people who were very senile. I've also met people who were mad. Can we say that these former people are people any longer, end quote? The room was aghast at the conclusions, as you should be. In a poll conducted in the spring of this year, life appearing from non-life is the number one reason. It is the number one reason intellectually and scientifically that atheists, by a poll, and agnostics have come to the conclusion of naturalistic evolutionary theology or thinking, or from atheism itself. It's the number one reason. They believe that science has taught that life has emerged from non-life. This, by a poll in March of 2016, in more than 3,000 people, again, more than half of the atheists and many of those who are agnostics say this is the number one reason, life appearing from non-life. Secondly, or thirdly, I should say, not only life from non-life, but look at this third component of the closed box, natural selection. I know that I'm asking you on Thanksgiving break, students, to think a lot. But let me ask you to think with me for a few more minutes, because central to evolutionary thought, naturalistic evolutionary thought, is the idea of natural selection. You see, when someone like me sees something in the biological world and says there's a designer behind the design, have you ever thought that? You ever looked and said, that looks like it's been designed? Those who believe in evolution are going to say, well, that's natural selection at work. Natural selection is the substitute for the divine designer in evolutionary thought. Let me give you two thoughts here regarding this. First comes from Harvard evolutionary biologist Ernest Mayr. He says, and you'll see this on the screen, the real core of Darwinism, however, is that the theory of natural selection, this theory is so important for the Darwinian because it permits the explanation of adaption. The design of the natural theologian by natural means instead of divine intervention. Again, natural selection, mutation throughout time, is the substitute for the divine designer. Now, I read this week, and you can find in my notes the footnote, where one individual, unlike the origin of species in Darwin felt bears eventually mutated into whales. This individual says, no, now we know it was cows that eventually mutated through natural selection into whales. Now, I want to just say something here, and I want to be as transparent, and I want to be as respectful as I can. For me to stand up and say that a dead man rose after 3 days in death may be laughed by scorn, and it may take tremendous faith for you to believe that. But does it no more beggar the imagination to say that cows turn into whales and pass it off for science? I'm not going to be nearly as embarrassed in believing in miracles, even among naturalists today. Natural selection is the substitute for the divine designer. What conclusions does this leave us to? Well, listen to George Gaylord Simpson in the 1967 book called The Meaning of Evolution. You'll see on the screens, man is the result of purposeless and natural processes that did not have him in mind. He was not planned. You see, naturalism functions as atheism and evolutionary thought. So much so that Dawkins, whom I referred to earlier in his book called The Selfish Gene, said that Darwinism, evolutionary theology or teaching, allows him to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. A moment ago, I told you the number one scientific objection to believing a divine designer. for atheists and agnostics in a March 2016 poll was that life appears from non-life. The second most influential fact for the agnostic and the atheist is natural selection. They point to natural selection as being the second most influential aspect of evolutionary thought in composing modern-day atheists and agnostics. When asked, why are we here, evolutionists will exclude God from the question. Evolution is a closed box. Secondly, I want you to see what I'm calling a finely tuned universe. In the first point, I simply, hopefully, allowed evolution to speak for itself. And the second point, I want to speak on behalf of those of us who believe in creation or others of you who believe in intelligent design. Finely tuned universe is not my language. I've got it from others. In fact, there's something remarkable, many scientists believe, there is something remarkable about our universe. Everything is just right to make life flourish. Even Stephen Hawking said, the remarkable fact, you'll see this on the screens, is that the value of these numbers, what numbers? The size of the electric charge of the electron, the ratio of the masses of the proton and the electron, the size, the value of these numbers seem to have been very finely adjusted to make possible the development of life. He says this in his highly popular book, A Brief History of Time. Now, Hawking is not a Baptist preacher, if you don't know that. He's not attending the Southern Baptist Convention anytime soon. But all of us agree that this universe is finely tuned. One individual said, it's so finely tuned, it looks as if life in the universe is standing on the edge of a knife. Again, let me help you with this by giving you three facts with regard to this. First, I would point to the force of gravity. The force of gravity. Why do I point to the force of gravity? There's many numbers out there. There's many scientific facts that both evolutionists and others both would agree in saying that our universe is finely tuned. But the force of gravity, as it works in what is known as the Big Bang Theory, let me share with you what that is. You may know the sitcom. Let me share with you the scientific theory. Prior to the scientific theory of the Big Bang Theory, there's no stars, planets, or galaxies, just atoms floating in the dark void of space. And the universe begins to expand outward from the Big Bang. Gravity pulls the matter of the universe ever so gently, pulling on the atoms, gathering them into clumps that eventually become stars and galaxies. But gravity had to have the right force. See, if gravity had been a bit stronger, it would have pulled all the atoms together into one big ball. One individual said instead of the Big Bang, you'd have the Big Crunch. But let's say it's weaker, just a tad bit weaker, not just a tad bit stronger, but what if it was a tad bit weaker the other direction? Then the expanding universe would have distributed the atoms so widely that they would have never been gathered into stars or galaxies. The strength of gravity had to be exact for stars to form as they are. Now, how exact, you might ask? Had the force of gravity been off to 1 to the 10th to the 60th power, to the 10 to the 60th power, I hope that you'll see that number in front of you, 10 to the 60th power, that's how exact the fine-tuning of gravitational force would be. Now, I don't know about you. I deal with a lot of numbers, but I don't deal with numbers 10 to the 60th power. I don't know how much student debt you're in. I hope it's not this much. I'm happy to report to you that the federal government isn't even in this much debt yet, but give us another 100 years, we'll get there. So 10 to the 60th, how close, how big is that? Well, a couple things by comparison. If you were to ask how many cells in the body, you have 10 to the 14th power cells in your body. But see, that still doesn't help me because of all the things I keep in my mind, I don't keep the number of cells in my body. So that didn't help me. But here's the one that did help me. If someone were to ask how many grains of sand are on the beaches are above water level on the earth. That's 10 to the 20th. 10 to the 20th. All the sand above water on our earth. Now you begin to see how big the number 10 to the 60th. And if it's off just by that much, scientists tell us, then the gravitational pull, the gravitational constant, can't put the glue of the Big Bang, put our universe together. The force of gravity. But secondly, look at the machinery of the cell. The machinery of the cell. I've gone to the skies above. Let me go to from the macro to the micro for just a minute. Let's talk molecular biology. See, when Darwin wrote his origin of the species. He did not have the technology that you and I have today, technology to let us look into the intricacies of life. He didn't have the human genome figured out, what we did in the Clinton administration, or Francis and Crick telling us the double helix. But today, we're able to look with great precision. One individual has referred to the cell in that discovery as a micro-miniaturized factory containing thousands of exquisitely designed pieces of inner molecular machinery. In fact, so much that a man named Michael Behe coined a term called irreducible complexity. That's a word I'd love for you to know and remember as you walk out. Irreducible complexity. Irreducible complexity refers to something that by itself cannot be reduced and still function. He refers to the flagellum of the cell, or many have referred to the eyeball. You see, left to itself, the eyeball of the flagellum cannot work unless it is in its present form. Again, go back to evolution. What's being said here is that either the eyeball of the flagellum is either all or nothing. All or nothing. When something is missing, it doesn't work. And when a system such as the cell cannot be constructed, it cannot be constructed in this gradual manner over time as evolution is proposing. It simply won't work. No mechanism, Darwin offers no mechanism for this. The machinery of the cell. Third, self-contradictory ethics. What do I mean by this? You see, when our students are taught evolution in classrooms in biology, they understand that the weak are eaten by the strong and the survival of the fittest. But then as they move into the classrooms, we're telling them, be kind to one another and don't be violent to one another. Don't you see the contradiction that's happening there? How is it at one time that life has evolved by the strong eating the weak and the violent and the survival of the fittest, but I'm not supposed to hit you. I'm not supposed to hurt you. Only when you put a designer behind the universe can you therefore say, thou shall not murder. And as you read a moment ago, we're to be kind to one another, tender-hearted, compassionate. Don't you see the consistency there? You need to say to yourself, if I'm an evolutionary biologist, if I'm one who believes in evolution, I'm not sure how I can teach an ethic. Third and lastly, creation and open truth. I find it insightful that Robert Ingersoll, a famous atheist of some time ago, was with pastor and preacher Henry Ward Beecher. Ingersoll was invited to come inside the pastor's library to look at all the theological books that was there. And Ingersoll, the atheist, walks in and sees a beautiful portrait, a beautiful painting of the globe with its valleys and its mountains. Ingersoll was touched by it. It was a beautiful work of art. So Ingersoll, the very bright man, the very highly educated, looks at the globe and says, Dr. Beecher, this is one of the most beautiful pieces of work I've ever seen. Who made it for you? To which Beecher smiled and said, oh, nobody. It just happened. You see, you may not, as a skeptic, be able to walk with me all the way to the belief that I have that Jesus Christ rose on the third day, that the scriptures that I have in front of me are complete, they're sufficient, and they're without error. You may not get all that way, but today I'm praying that I might give you a pause. And I believe that there is a creator, and I believe that not blindly, I believe that the evidence leads me to that. The Bible's teaching on creation are threefold. First, the Bible teaches that creation out of nothing. Everything was created out of nothing. What do I mean by that? It means that God took nothing and made it into something. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3. Would you read this passage with me off the screen? Ready? By faith, we understand that the universe was created by the word of God so that what is seen was not made out of things that are visible. Friend, I understand that my position is by faith. I believe in a creator. I can't prove it to you. I don't have a test tube. I can't show you the chemistry, the biology, but neither can you show me your teaching of evolution other than those two little words, by faith. It's faith versus faith. And we ought to be honest enough. Where science leads us, we need to make our own conclusions. The Bible teaches us that we're created out of nothing. Kyle Simpson was 27 raised as a believer when PBS, Public Broadcasting System, published his deconversion story. I quote, "I don't believe in God, but I really want to." That's the problem with questions like these, is that you don't have anything that clearly states, yes, this is a fact. So I'm constantly, Simpson, the 27-year-old, says, I'm constantly struggling. But looking right at the facts, evolution and science, they're saying, no, there's none. But then he continues, but what about love? What about forgiveness? I like to believe that they are true and they are meaningful. The Bible's teaching is that we're created from nothing. Secondly, you're created in the image of God. You're created in the image of God. Listen carefully and look directly at me. You are not an accidental collection of atoms or molecules. You are made with the full intentionality of the most intelligent being of the universe. If you're teetering on whether life is worth existing, I want you to know, the Bible says in Genesis 1, 26 and 27, that God, quoting him, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth." And here's the money sentence. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created the male and female. He created them. The Bible is really clear that you're not a fortuitous collection of atoms and molecules. You're not here by chance. There's dignity, and I believe that leads us to all kinds of conclusions. I believe that that leads us into things that we'll discuss next week, but your life is worth tremendous value. You know, your life, look at me, your life is not contingent on how much money you make. Your life, young lady, is not contingent on how good-looking you are. The worth of your life is not to be measured in if you're married or your disability. The worth of your life is that the intelligent creator breathed life into your soul. You're not here by chance. You're here by God's choice. Further, you need to be aware that evolutionary teaching directly forbids the Bible's teaching of God creating Adam and Eve. You see, the Bible's really clear. Eve did not have a mother, and Adam did not have a father. If you believe in evolutionary teaching as it's presented, those two have ancestors, but the Bible presents these two as being directly created by God himself. The Bible teaches that God created everything out of nothing. It teaches that we are made in the image of God. And third, there's a purpose for creation. And the purpose is that God is a show-off. He is a show-off. My grandmother told me never to be a show-off. You know what a show-off is? To show of your brilliance. But God's rules are different than my rules. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare what? What do the heavens declare? The glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his handiwork. A young college student came to his pastor after the pastor spoke on creation. Said, "Pastor, do you believe that there's life on other planets?" The pastor said, "No, I don't." "Well, if there's no life on other planets, why did God go to all the trouble to create all these other galaxies?" The pastor said, "What trouble?" Don't you see the amazing intellectual ability? No wonder the prophet Isaiah said, "His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. His ways are higher than our ways." Don't you understand that the peaks of the mountains and the valleys of the canyons, the depth of the ocean, the deserts of the Middle East, to the beauty of the United States of America and Canada, show us the incredible imaginary ability of this Creator? He's showing off. He's showing off. I'm almost finished. I want you to see something. This is a by faith position. Among them, Carl Sagan and others were looking for intelligence in universes around our planet. You know why? Because certain waves, certain science led them to believe that something was created and being emanated toward our Earth. So we've set up satellites to look for intelligence elsewhere. Why is it that we look for intelligence in the galaxy? But at the origin of the universe, we are convinced it's by chance and no intelligence there. My friend, it is the same by faith position. If you're going to be an atheist evolutionary and create a satellite for intelligence in the universe, then why won't you posit, why wouldn't you conclude that an intelligent creator, put together all things. Friend, you are a magnificent creation of an almighty God. You were born once physically that you might be born again spiritually by faith in our Lord Jesus Christ. You were created that you might serve God, know God, and love God, and even live with Him forever. And while you and I weren't there at the beginning, we can be with God in the end through faith in Jesus.